Welcome to Let Us Fails, Speculative Futures in Digital Librarianship, a special publication for the Journal of Critical Digital Librarianship. This is episode two, Speculative Future Solution, Play at Work, Normalize Failure. I'm Natalia Estrada. I'm the Digital Scholarship Librarian at the University of Buffalo. I am joined with my colleagues.
Yes, I'm Christina Bush. I am the online learning librarian at Tufts University.
And I'm Stacey Snyder, Educational Support Project Manager at the University of Buffalo.
And today we are going to talk about some of the challenges related to digital librarianship and some of our possible futures that we would love to see to get around that. So we are going to do this in kind of big themes. And I'm going to start with Christina. And Christina, you have this, let's say, issue around metrics. Can you talk about this?
Absolutely. So, yeah, I am facing a challenge when it comes to metrics, and this is something that I would like us to speculate on. How can we solve this in our future? So, the traditional like quantitative measures of assessment aren't particularly useful when it comes to creating digital learning objects or other aspects of digital scholarship, right? So, when I say that, I mean if you are teaching workshops, for example, then there are easy ways to assess like how many people showed up. You submit a feedback form and whatnot, and that's like how you assess the success of it. How many people registered, how many people actually appeared. And that's the type of librarianship that many of our colleagues do, right? They have workshops, they teach classes. You can count how many classes that you teach, how many like course integrated sessions you have. So for that type of work, then you assess your success by how many sessions you teach. It's all quantitative, right? And it's easy to measure in certain ways. However, with online learning objects, with other types of digital scholarship, those type of measures aren't going to work quite as well. The success of an online learning object isn't how many people clicked on it, or how many people submitted the quiz. The success of a digital humanities project isn't how many people have seen it, for example. So we need a more flexible approach to that that includes feedback and iteration and is mindful of the design that we put into these objects, right? Because design thinking is about iteration and it's about failure. And design thinking is something that I personally like to do, and I have worked really hard to become anti-perfectionist and be okay with putting out products that are not perfect for the purpose of iteration. And it's a way I like to work, and it's a way that works for this type of scholarship for digital librarianship. However, it is not supported by traditional librarianship, right? So what I need is a way to play and to experiment that and that be included in metrics and that be included in the way that I go about applying for a promotion or applying for a merit increase or whatever. I want to be able to show my success without being tied to these really traditional modes of assessment. So metrics make play and experimentation more difficult because they want to show that things are successful in a way that's quantifiable, but that data is just not actually useful when developing creative products, right? So I'm talking about design, I'm talking about iteration. I need real feedback. Like I need good, honest feedback to make something better. I can't say, oh, well, 100 people interacted with this, so I guess it's fine. Like I need them to actually tell me, like, all right, what was your user experience here? Did you meet my learning goals? Did this help you to understand how to do your assignment? I need different types of feedback
I think this
that,
is like, yeah, I think this is like a kind of like a kind of a very academically traditional aspect of like, how do you assess by essentially you count the bodies in a room. If they make eye contact with you, then clearly you are engaging with them and they are engaging with you and they are learning. As opposed to say, especially for someone who's like with ADHD or something like that, if you're fidgeting or if you're like not paying attention or like what looks like not paying attention, then you've lost the crowd and thus it's a failure. But you don't know exactly what is going on with that student. kind of a thing. So like that kind of ties into the issues of metrics as well.
What I wanted to say about qualitative feedback that you want is there are challenges with that because it can be very difficult to get, because you can send surveys or questionnaires to the people who are using the objects that you create, but you don't have any guarantee that you're going to get responses or that you're going to get enough responses to be significant. And then even if you do get the responses that you would like, how do you collate those into a way that is meaningful for your supervisor or for whoever it is that's looking at your work to decide if you deserve that promotion? And also, it takes a lot more time to administer a survey, to collect the results, to analyze the results than it does to count the number of people who accessed it or to count the number of people who are in the seats. Mm-hmm. So you are increasing your workload in that way because you're trying to be innovative, but in being innovative, you're making more work for yourself.
Yes.
And that's kind of a challenge because I think sometimes I guess I should just speak for myself, you get kind of feel defeated sometimes. It's like, I'm putting all of this work into this new thing and it doesn't seem to matter to the people that make the decisions. So how do we get that stuff to matter?
Yes. And the other thing I'm thinking too is that, like, yes, a lot of this is probably going to resonate with people who do traditional in-person instruction as well, right? Because I'm sure they want, you know, formative assessment. They want to make sure that students are learning. But also with digital products, it's different because, like Stacy said, and Natalia said as well, like, we're not making eye contact with the people using it. We're not actually like assessing in time. We go about making something. We put it out into the universe and we hope that it works. We hope it resonates. So the entire design process, it's a different approach. It's different than writing a lesson plan and then you go and do it and you're like, all right, okay, I flopped. I'll try it different next time. You don't have that kind of like agility, right? You have to get a certain amount of people to interact with something before you can actually iterate on it. And the amount of time that goes into developing online learning objects, that goes into learning the software that you're using to create something, that goes into designing the outcomes, making the content, like editing the content, figuring out the hosting situation. Like, there are so many other considerations that build on that. And speaking for myself, I also have like a million other responsibilities. Like, I'm seeing nods. We all have a million other responsibilities. So it's like, how am I supposed to do all of these things at the same time as also teaching in person and like doing my liaison work and all of this stuff? And that ability to play and experiment and learn the softwares, do all of this additional work that is required to make good online learning objects, to make good digital product, it's not currently supported. So when I imagine my future digital librarian world, I want to be supported through that process. I want time, I want space, I want agency to be able to put the time that I need into that play, into that experimentation, into learning what I need to learn and having time to talk to people and say, hey, how does this look? You know, is this working for you? That's the world that I want. And I want to like hear more from you all too. Like, how would you build on this world where we get this play and this experimentation and this freedom from this many people did this thing and, you know, those ties to traditional measures of success in academic scholarship?
Oh, yeah. No, I've been thinking about this too, because a lot of times I work with students, but also with faculty and trying to learn new things, new platforms, new methods of thinking. And it is very hard to do if a lot of the time they are thinking like, how do I actually present this to an outside evaluator? So say like people who are going up for promotion. So I teach new faculty who come in for their first year on how to do publishing. I do a co-facilitation of that program. And we try to introduce them to new platforms, new ways of publishing podcasts. And a lot of times they say, that's really cool. How do I get this measured for tenure? And so what I usually do, depending on hope to usually do, is just allow, like, I would love a future, or like, I would love the environment. If it was up to me, the ability to just have like time that isn't restricted, just like time is a huge thing. To be able to just say, I have nothing else to do. Nobody is forcing me to go anywhere. I don't have a ton of meetings. I don't have to be at a bunch of responsibilities. I can sit down with, say, like a group of people who also want to learn something. And we are given the thing, we are given some guidelines or some like instructions, some like, you know, basic how to's. And we go at it. It's kind of like, I approach it with kind of like how I approach Legos. So if you know me, I am an adult Lego fan. And I actually have a box of Legos in my office for teaching. And usually I've seen other instructors use this. There's a historian and I believe a social scientist who actually has made a qualitative research data management workshop using Legos. And, you know, just the ability to just take the tool or take toys and just like play around for a bit, see what works, what doesn't. It's very like natural with Legos. And so like, I want to be able to like take that same approach to like a software, a new method of thinking, like textual analysis. How do you do this with, say, like topic modeling? How do you approach with like a Python library like Spacey to do with like a huge text, just like to play around with it? I imagine that future to be able to just have that time and just like have the support and just like, especially that framework of, we're just going to play around and find out and see what happens if we do this. And we don't have to worry about like all of the other like kind of administrative aspects of it all and all the other quantifiable things.
What Natalia was describing, what you've both described, are both absolutely things that need to happen for this to continue. And especially, you know, Natalia, what you were saying about getting a group together, and that can't be a one-off thing.
No,
that can't be you know, some Friday afternoon in October and then you forget about it, because you have to play with the thing and you have to have time and that extended time to experiment and then come back together and show each other what you learned and think about how you can apply what you've learned to current projects or to upcoming projects. So I'm thinking from the evaluation aspect of that, and I mean evaluation of us as employees, is the evaluation measures have to change. And they can't necessarily be the same for every position. So, you know, if you're a subject liaison who's teaching, you know, one shots, you know, several times a week and doing your publications and whatever, that's one set of measurements, and that's okay. You get to the digital librarians and you know, anyone who is creating learning objects or, you know, anything that we're putting out there for the world, there needs to be a different measurement for that kind of work. And, you know, I could say maybe it's, how many things did you create? What did you learn? How did you apply what you learned? How did you go about learning it? You know, maybe documenting the process. You know, there are a lot of different ways, but we have to pull out of that one size fits all evaluation. And I know that that's really difficult on an institutional level, because, you know, institutions are very good at creating the widgets, and we're historically have created widgets in a lot of ways. So how do we get past that when we're doing our evaluation?
I will say that
free of the widgets.
Yeah, do we need the widgets? But like what I was thinking when you were talking about that is, you know, what I usually think of is, I think of projects that are out there that act as kind of like guiding light, as essentially just like, they're kind of towing the line of doing stuff that in theory could be seen as like, you know, very frivolous, but also it's very much play. It's very much joy. They are having fun doing these projects, but still can be assessed in some like scholarly, like traditional academic metric way. My first thought was the Data Sitters Club. The Data Sitters Club has been doing a lot of work on textual analysis. For those who are not aware, this is a project in which a number of digital humanities folks got together and do textual analysis of the Babysitters Club, because they discovered that there's no scholarly research into the Babysitters Club. The Data Sitters Club is a project started by the following researchers: Lee Scallenrup Bessett, Katia Bowers, Maria Sachiko Cesare, Quinn Dombrowski, Anuk Long, Rupika Rizam, and Mark Algie Hewitt. And at first, you could think of that as just like they're messing around with the Babysitters Club and just seeing what happens. But they are also publishing. They are also teaching others. They are also talking about the process and talking about like what has worked for them, what hasn't, and in a way that is very innovative, but can also be, you know, viewed and kind of generally assessed in like a traditional aspect. And so when I see projects like that, I see that as essentially just there is a way. And there is a way to be able to do metrics and be able to like still be able to have fun and still play, but be able to take into like the accounts to like be able to see like how many people are reaching out, how many people are like actually interacting and stuff like that. So that's kind of what I mean for like at least for something to give guidance and still give me hope in a way. Christina, you had a thought.
Yeah, I feel like that's like the middle ground, right? That's our we're breaking free, but I want to go even farther than that. And like Stacey said, like how many products? No, not how many products. That's capitalist. So how do we imagine this like breaking free even farther from that? Like I loved what Stacey said about like quantifying success by learning. I would be all about that. I want my evaluations just to be like, how much did you learn? And yeah. So I think like if we're imagining a brand new world, this world creates time for play. It creates time for experimentation and for those learning communities that Natalia was talking about, where you can just sit together and share what you've learned and learn together and experiment and have fun and dream bigger in a collaborative community setting. So we're imagining a university, because that's the world we're in. So we'll just stick with universities, where we're allowed to have those communities. And maybe those are even communities that are outside of a particular university. They could go beyond. We could have the Northeast, or, you know, national. It could, you know, international. Whoa. Communities to learn together and talk about what we're doing with these tools and technologies. Also, like, let us fail. That's all part of experimentation, right? Is to be allowed to fail and learn from it. So we're gonna throw out quantitative measures of success. We're tossing them. They're in the trash, and we're using learning as our measure of success. Did the students learn? Did we learn? Like, how much fun did you have? Did you find joy in this? Because we should all find joy in our work. We shouldn't just be trying to produce stuff and like tied into that. Like, you must be innovative, but there's no creativity and innovation anymore. And especially digital librarianship. Go ahead, Stacey.
Yeah. And also what you were saying, like the title of this podcast, Let Us Fail. Not all of those experimentations that we do are going to lead to anything. I was going to say lead to anything good. They might not lead to anything at all. We might, you know, have these times, you know, working with our groups and experimenting with something and realize, yeah, this software is not great. Or this software is great, but it doesn't have any immediate applicability. And to be able to say that is important too, because I think so often people will hear of the latest new thing.
Yeah.
You know, they're at a conference, they hear a thing, they talk to a colleague, oh, well, there's this new thing for text analysis, or this new thing for slow computing or whatever. And then they come back, and I have to admit that I'm picturing the supervisor in this role, the one who comes back with this word and says, hey, I heard about thus and such at the conference. do you think we should use that? Or do you think that that's worth something? And to then what the supervisor needs to do is not just to say, tell me if this is something that we should use, but give us time to explore that and the permission to come back and say, this is not the thing for us. I think that we've all had experience with something that is supposed to be the latest and greatest, and we realize, not so much.
I will also throw in, so I think one other concept that's kind of helpful here, and this is something that I think it's just been more brought up in the general academic space, but the concept of leisure and learning leisure, just learning for the sake of learning. So leisure learning is essentially this idea that you're learning just because you want to learn. Like, there is no general benefit for, like, your work or for, like, self-improvement or whatever. It's just you're learning because you're learning. You have the free time and you would like to do that. And normally, like, I've seen this conversation come along in, like, the concept of classics education. So, like, I want to learn Greek because I want to learn ancient Greek or whatever. Not because it makes me a better businessman. Or just, like, I want to learn, like, the great books or whatever. But I feel like that's the same theory or like a same application that can be used in digital librarianship, where it's just like, I just want to learn this thing because I want to learn this thing. And I think the students should be able to do that too, or just like anybody that we're doing these products for, or just as like new platforms or new learning methods, we should be able to do that and say, this is a thing people can learn because this is a thing they can learn. And so like, I feel like having that thought idea where it's just like, we shouldn't have a reason. We shouldn't have a metric or some goal to hit. We should just be able to say, like, this is a freedom and this should be like a thing that we should be encouraging for all of our community members, that they should just be able to take the ability and like some time to themselves and to just learn whatever it is that they want to learn at that moment. Do they want to learn like a new textual analysis process? Go ahead, just for the sake of it. Sure. Do they want to learn how to build a website just because? Go ahead. Anything else? Like, that should be a philosophy that we should be approaching. And I think that's kind of forgotten at times.
We need like paid learning sabbaticals.
Oh my God. I think you have to get tenure first.
See, well, that brings us to our next challenge.
Our next challenge, which is a group discussion. We are going to talk about promotion and job security. Speaking of which, so Stacey, do you want to start us off? What are your thoughts on promotion and job security?
Well, in a way, this kind of comes back to the union thing that I think I mentioned in our last episode. And within the State University of New York, we have faculty who get tenure, which I think most universities still have, although I know some universities are getting rid of tenure for their faculty. But the professional staff also gets kind of the equivalent of tenure, which is permanent appointment. And it's the same sort of timeline. Of course, the requirements are different, but it's basically, you know, at the 7-year mark, if you've done what you're supposed to do in your time working here, you get permanent appointment, which is kind of the same as tenure, meaning that you are not easily fired. It's not an at-will employment kind of situation. And I think that it has, you know, the benefits of tenure have been published ad nauseum elsewhere. I think that it does come into, you know, a problem when we're dealing with the innovative stuff that we've been talking about, and when you need to have those measurements, like Christina was talking about, to get to that tenure, to get your tenure, to get your permanent appointment. And then that's where we need the different evaluation.
Yeah. And I mean, the issue, especially in academic librarianship and digital librarianship and like working in libraries in general, is that for especially early career or like early on while working, you're pretty much at the mercy of like, what do you produce? Do you produce anything that has some form of impact? And it has to show success as well. If you're on the tenure track, you have to have a certain number of publications, and those publications have to be at a certain metric, and they have to have been seen by others, and they have to have impact, and they have to be in a way that is easy to measure. If you're like, up for like permanent status or just some form of job security in the library staff in some form, you have to show usefulness. You have to show that your job matters in a way. And for digital scholarship, digital librarianship, digital, like working in the digital sphere, that could be really tricky. And especially like when you think about, one, how long the platforms last, like, you know, what is the new sexy thing and can that new sexy thing last for quite some time? I especially am confronting this because I am secretly also the AI librarian somehow, and AI has been on the topic of a lot of people's minds, and I don't know how long that will last. But, you know, you have to be proficient at it, and you have to see, like, how long this will go, and you can't fail at any point. Christina, I know you have thoughts on this as well.
Yes, exactly right. You can't fail. So at Tufts, we don't have tenure or a tenure equivalent. So my work is tied to those metrics, which is why it's my challenge, because I will not, you know, get promoted, get my merit increase, not be able to stay here if I don't produce stuff and I can't show that I'm producing stuff. But something else that we wanted to mention is that a lot of digital librarian work is contract based or grant based. So short term, the job is tied to a particular project or a particular product, a particular software. So those jobs are especially precarious and don't have much security or any security because they are so short term. But digital products are always going to be tied to risk. Digital scholarship will always be tied to risk. And that also goes back to what we talked about, where experimentation needs to be built into this work. Yeah. Because it will always be risky. It'll always take time to learn and figure out what you're doing and how you want to put it out there. But yeah, like all of these modes of promotion, modes of measuring success are tied to traditional scholarly output. So we need to expand that.
Yeah, we need to expand that. And then also we need to be able to figure out ways that, like, you know, there are folks out there who are experimenting in different ways of producing scholarship. Obviously, we are right here. But Katina Rogers has been helping lead with, she helped with, I think, Syracuse University develop the next gen dissertations, where it is folks who have completed dissertations, but they do it in a way that, you know, it's innovative. So there was the first ever peer reviewed rap album. There was, you know, a series of podcasts about Victorian Gothic, folks who've done gamified dissertations. And so, but it's still a small number, not big enough to be able to like cause a big shift, to be able for us to get out of this like very tight, stringent like way of getting through promotion and tenure, and also to make sure that our contract coworkers and whatnot get to stay on in a more permanent, sustainable method. So what can we imagine then as like a more equitable and like a better future for all of us?
Well, I think that when we're talking about tenure, it's not just for the librarians who are doing the digital librarianship. Yeah. It is for the faculty that we often work with on these projects. And you often will have, you know, the junior faculty, like Natalia was mentioning before, who are very, very, very interested in doing digital scholarship projects, but they don't count toward tenure, or they can't figure out how to make them count toward their tenure. So the junior faculty who may have some really wonderful, bright, fresh ideas don't feel comfortable putting the time into those projects because it may not count for their tenure. So oftentimes then it leads to tenured faculty coming in and doing the work, which is not to say that they don't always also have really good ideas, but it feels like we can't, not allowing that in the tenure process is doing a disservice to those ideas. And that maybe by the time those faculty members get tenure, they won't have the idea anymore, or they'll have moved on to other things. So it's the ideal, I think, for the future will be to treat digital scholarship on par with traditional scholarship. And I know that that's a huge paradigm shift for universities. You know, in some disciplines, it's like your 10-year, your dossier is, you know, how many monographs did you publish? In others, it's how many articles did you publish in peer-reviewed journals? You know, it's, and we have to figure out how to equate a digital scholarship project with one of those things.
I was just kind of reminded of what Stacy said when we were talking about metrics and that we need to break free of this one size fits all model and valuing learning over output. So that to me also sounds like valuing process over product, right? That's something that also just as a design thinking nerd, process is valued over product for that for design thinking as well. So I'm wondering, how do we tie process to job security? Because, you know, I would love to have job security. That sounds wonderful. And I would love to not have to jump through all of the hoops to get to get it. Yeah. So how do we reimagine academia or these types of jobs that we have where we have the security that would make us feel comfortable without having to submit to the traditional academic publishing to be able to get it? How do we not have to check these boxes that maybe don't align with the work that we do or the work that we're interested in doing?
So in my mind, I think of two things. And I think of, like, they both fall under the general theme of being more publicly open about these kinds of things. And the first one is discussing more about these projects and the way that people have responded to it. I am thinking of especially around the creation of Zotero. So if you've worked in academia, you've probably have used or have seen the citation management tool Zotero. I am a huge user of it. But one of the researchers who worked on Zotero and its creation was when he was going through the tenure process, and he had written about it as well. He mentioned that there was a discussion on whether Zotero, the creation of it, counted as service or scholarship, and that they were leaning towards counting it as service and thus possibly affecting his tenure vote. And so there was this whole discussion about, like, what do these kinds of, like, projects, how do these count in the larger world of academia? How do we get people to understand how we frame them and how we use them as well? In 2013, Sean Takatz, then the Director of Research Projects for the Roy Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media, and the co-director of the Zotero Project at the time, went up for tenure and at a vote of 10-2 was able to achieve tenure, though there was discussion about the role of Zotero, whether as scholarship or as service, with a note from the portfolio, quote, "The committee also recognizes considerable work at the Rosenzweig Center for History and New Media as it relates to projects such as Zotero and the substantial funds he and his collaborators have raised to help sustain them. Some of the committee questioned to what degree Dr. Takatz's involvement in these activities constitutes actual research as opposed to project management. Hence, some determined that projects like Zotero et al., while highly valuable, should be considered as major service activity instead." This is from Sean Takatz's personal website in 2013, titled "A Digital Humanities Tenure Case, Part 2, Letters and Committee." The other way I'm thinking about it as well is talking more openly about failing, which is kind of what we're doing here. And I'm especially thinking about the collection of essays from Sean Graham, Failing Gloriously and Other Essays. And what Sean writes about his experience is failing to get any form of a permanent position. This is very much a job, like a book about job precarity, and then also like where things have failed in his projects. So Sean Graham is a digital humanist over in Canada, I believe at the University of Carleton in Ottawa, and written in this collection of essays about having to work as a substitute teacher in various aspects after graduating with his PhD, not being able to find like steady work for a while, but then also talking about when he did start working on big projects in the tenure faculty position, how big problems happened, including one that just disappeared, or like one that had like all these vulnerabilities that led it to become unusable, and how he had to write about how it failed and how he was so embarrassed about it, but then how people responded to it. And so I think that trend really is going to help us out. It's a stepping stone, but I think talking more and more about like these kinds of aspects is going to help us get to where people become more comfortable in taking these as scholarship and things that are worth considering. But then also just like allow more people in review positions to like allow them to have more freedom.
I love thinking about talking about failure as a stepping stone. And yeah, that's like process over product, right? Where if we would get the same amount of success, I guess, from a failure, if that makes sense. Like a failure would be valued equally to a success. That's what I'm trying to say.
There we go.
That's what we're seeing in our future, is failure is the valued equally to success.
So I want to take a bit of a pause, because I want to save the next couple of topics for episode 3.
Can do a quick summary.
Yeah, go ahead.
Our demands, or what?
Yes,
we
please.
We
see in the future. I would love a summary of our demands.
Amazing. All right. So we need to be supported in experimentation, play, and failure.
Yes.
We need measures of assessment and promotion to be based around this standard. And we cannot be held to purely quantitative. Traditional.
There you go.
Traditional measures of performance when we must fail to learn and to succeed.
We would like to thank Samantha Quinone-Snare for helping form and refine ideas for this project. We would also like to thank Chris Chung and CJ Keough for their technical assistance, and Yanina Mueller and Sophie Ziegler for providing feedback.